Chapter 48. Lady Dedlock, it was not so easy as it had appeared at first, to arrange for Richard's making a trial of Mr. Kenge's office. Richard himself was the chief impediment. As soon as he had it in his power to leave Mr. Badger at any moment, he began to doubt whether he wanted to leave him at all. He didn't know, he said, really. It wasn't a bad profession. He couldn't assert that he disliked it. Perhaps he liked it as well as he liked any other. Suppose he gave it one more chance. Upon that, he shut himself up for a few weeks with some books and some bones and seemed to acquire a considerable fund of information with great rapidity. His fervor, after lasting about a month, began to cool, and when it was quite cooled, began to grow warm again. His vacillations between law and medicine lasted so long that midsummer arrived before he finally separated from Mr. Badger and entered on an experimental course of Messrs. Kenge and Carboy. For all his waywardness, he took great credit to himself as being determined to be in earnest this time. And he was so good-natured throughout, and in such high spirits, and so fond of Ada, that it was very difficult indeed to be otherwise than pleased with him. As to Mr. Jarndyce, who, I may mention, found the wind much given, during this period, to stick in the east, as to Mr. Jarndyce, Richard would say to me, he is the finest fellow in the world, Esther. I must be particularly careful, if it were only for his satisfaction, to take myself well to task, and have a regular wind-up of this business now. The idea of his taking himself well to task, with that laughing face and heedless manner, and with a fancy that everything could catch, and nothing could hold, was ludicrously anomalous. However, he told us between whiles that he was doing it to such an extent that he wondered his hair didn't turn gray. His regular wind-up of the business was, as I have said, that he went to Mr. Kenge's about midsummer to try how he liked it. All this time he was, in money affairs, what I have described him in a former illustration: generous, profuse, wildly careless, but fully persuaded that he was rather calculating and prudent. I happened to say to Ada, in his presence, half jestingly, half seriously, about the time of his going to Mr. Kenge's, that he needed to have Fortunatus's purse. He made so light of money, which he answered in this way: "My jewel of a dear cousin, you hear this old woman? Why does she say that? Because I gave £8 odd, or whatever it was, for a certain neat waistcoat and buttons a few days ago. Now, if I had stayed at Badger's, I should have been obliged to spend £12 at a blow for some heartbreaking lecture fees. So I make £4 in a lump by the transaction." It was a question much discussed between him and my guardian what arrangements should be made for his living in London, while he experimented on the law, for we had long since gone back to Bleak House, and it was too far off to admit of his coming there oftener than once a week. My guardian told me that, if Richard were to settle down at Mr. Kenge's, he would take some apartments or chambers, where we two could occasionally stay for a few days at a time. "But, little woman," he added, rubbing his head very significantly, "he hasn't settled down there yet. The discussions ended in our hiring for him, by the month, a neat little furnished lodging in a quiet old house near Queen Square. He immediately began to spend all the money he had in buying the oddest little ornaments and luxuries for this lodging. And so often as Ada and I dissuaded him from making any purchase that he had in contemplation which was particularly unnecessary and expensive, he took credit for what it would have cost, and made out that to spend anything less on something else was to save the difference. While these affairs were in abeyance, our visit to Mr. Boythorn's was postponed. At length, Richard having taken possession of his lodging, there was nothing to prevent our departure. He could have gone with us at that time of the year very well, but he was in the full novelty of his new position, and was making most energetic attempts to unravel the mysteries of the fatal suit. Consequently, we went without him, and my darling was delighted to praise him for being so busy. We made a pleasant journey down into Lincolnshire by the coach, and had an entertaining companion in Mr. Skimpole. His furniture had been all cleared off, it appeared, by the person who took possession of it on his blue-eyed daughter's birthday, but he seemed quite relieved to think that it was gone. Chairs and table, he said, were wearisome objects. They were monotonous ideas, they had no variety of expression, they looked you out of countenance, and you looked them out of countenance. How pleasant, then, to be bound to no particular chairs and tables, but to sport like a butterfly among all the furniture on hire, and to flit from rosewood to mahogany, and from mahogany to walnut, and from this shape to that, as the humor took one. The oddity of the thing is, said Mr. Skimpole with a quickened sense of the ludicrous, that my chairs and tables were not paid for, and yet my landlord walks off with them as composedly as possible. Now, that seems droll. There is something grotesque in it. The chair and table merchant never engaged to pay my landlord my rent. Why should my landlord quarrel with him? If I have a pimple on my nose which is disagreeable to my landlord's peculiar ideas of beauty, my landlord has no business to scratch my chair and table merchant's nose, which has no pimple on it. His reasoning seems defective. Well, said my guardian good-humoredly, it's pretty clear that whoever became security for those chairs and tables will have to pay for them. Exactly, returned Mr. Skimpole. That's the crowning point of unreason in the business. I said to my landlord, my good man, you are not aware that my excellent friend Jarndyce will have to pay for those things that you are sweeping off in that indelicate manner. Have you no consideration for his property? Apostrophe he hadn't the least. And refused all proposals, said my guardian. Refused all proposals, returned Mr. Skimpole. I made him business proposals. I had him into my room. I said, you are a man of business, I believe? Apostrophe apostrophe he replied, I am, apostrophe very well, said I, now let us be businesslike. Here is an inkstand, here are pens and paper, here are wafers. What do you want? I have occupied your house for a considerable period, I believe to our mutual satisfaction until this unpleasant misunderstanding arose. Let us be at once friendly and businesslike. What do you want? Apostrophe in reply to this, he made use of the figurative expression which has something Eastern about it, that he had never seen the color of my money. My amiable friend, apostrophe said I never have any money. I never know anything about money. Apostrophe well, sir, apostrophe said he, what do you offer, if I give you time? Apostrophe apostrophe my good fellow, apostrophe said I have no idea of time, but you say you are a man of business, and whatever you can suggest to be done in a business-like way with pen, and ink, and paper and wafers I am ready to do. Don't pay yourself at another man's expense which is foolish, but be business-like. Apostrophe apostrophe however, he wouldn't be, and there was an end of it. If these were some of the inconveniences of Mr. Skimpole's childhood, it assuredly possessed its advantages too. On the journey he had a very good appetite for such refreshment as came in our way, including a basket of choice hothouse peaches, but never thought of paying for anything. So when the coachman came round for his fee, he pleasantly asked him what he considered a very good fee indeed, now a liberal one, and on his replying half a crown for a single passenger, said it was little enough to, all things considered, and left Mr. Jarndyce to give it him. It was delightful weather. The green corn waved so beautifully, the larks sang so joyfully, the hedges were so full of wild flowers, the trees were so thickly out in leaf, the bean fields, with a light wind blowing over them, filled the air with such a delicious fragrance. Late in the afternoon we came to the market town, where we were to alight from the coach, a dull little town with a church spire, and a market place, and a market cross, and one intensely sunny street, and a pond with an old horse cooling his legs in it, and a very few men sleepily lying and standing about in narrow little bits of shade. After the rustling of the leaves, and the waving of the corn all along the road, it looked as still, as hot, as motionless a little town as England could produce. At the inn we found Mr. Boythorn on horseback, waiting with an open carriage to take us to his house, which was a few miles off. He was overjoyed to see us, and dismounted with great alacrity. "By heaven," said he after giving us a courteous greeting, "this a most infamous coach. It is the most flagrant example of an abominable public vehicle that ever encumbered the face of the earth. It is 25 minutes after its time this afternoon. The coachman ought to be put to death." "Is he after his time?" said Mr. Skimpole, to whom he happened to address himself. "You know my infirmity." 25 minutes. 26 minutes, replied Mr. Boythorn, referring to his watch. "With two ladies in the coach, this scoundrel has deliberately delayed his arrival 26 minutes. Deliberately. It is impossible that it can be accidental. But his father and his uncle were the most profligate coachmen that ever sat upon a box." While he said this in tones of the greatest indignation, he handed us into the little phaeton with the utmost gentleness, and was all smiles and pleasure. "I am sorry, ladies," he said, standing bareheaded at the carriage door when all was ready, "that I am obliged to conduct you nearly 2 miles out of the way. But our direct road lies through Sir Leicester Dedlock's park, and in that fellow's property I have sworn never to set foot of mine, or horse's foot of mine, pending the present relations between us, while I breathe the breath of life." And here, catching my guardian's eye, he broke into one of his tremendous laughs, which seemed to shake even the motionless little market town. "Are the Dedlocks down here, Lawrence?" said my guardian as we drove along, and Mr. Boythorn trotted on the green turf by the roadside. "Sir Arrogant Numbskull is here," replied Mr. Boythorn. "Ha ha ha! Sir Arrogant is here, and I am glad to say, has been laid by the heels here. My lady," in naming whom he always made a courtly gesture, as if particularly to exclude her from any part in the quarrel, "is expected, I believe, daily. I am not in the least surprised that she postpones her appearance as long as possible. Whatever can have induced that transcendent woman to marry that effigy and figurehead of a baronet is one of the most impenetrable mysteries that ever baffled human inquiry. Ha 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 ha! I suppose," said my guardian, laughing, "we may set foot in the park while we are here? The prohibition does not extend to us, does it?" "I can lay no prohibition on my guests," he said, bending his head to Ada and me with the smiling politeness which sat so gracefully upon him, "except in the matter of their departure. I am only sorry that I cannot have the happiness of being their escort about Chesney Wold, which is a very fine place. But by the light of this summer day, Jarndyce, if you call upon the owner while you stay with me, you are likely to have but a cool reception. He carries himself like an 8-day clock at all times, like one of a race of 8-day clocks in gorgeous cases that never go and never went, ha ha ha, but he will have some extra stiffness, I can promise you, for the friends of his friend and neighbor Boythorn." "I shall not put him to the proof," said my guardian. "He is as indifferent to the honor of knowing me, I dare say, as I am to the honor of knowing him. The air of the grounds and perhaps such a view of the house as any other sightseer might get are quite enough for me." "Well," said Mr. Boythorn, "I am glad of it on the whole. It's in better keeping. I am looked upon about here as a second Ajax defying the lightning. Ha 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 ha! When I go into our little church on a Sunday, a considerable part of the inconsiderable congregation expect to see me drop, scorched and withered, on the pavement under the Dedlock displeasure. Ha 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 ha! I have no doubt he is surprised that I don't. For he is, by heaven, the most self-satisfied, and the shallowest, and the most coxcombical, and utterly brainless ass. Our coming to the ridge of a hill we had been ascending enabled our friend to point out Chesney Wold itself to us, and diverted his attention from its master. It was a picturesque old house in a fine park richly wooded. Among the trees, and not far from the residence, he pointed out the spire of the little church of which he had spoken. Oh, the solemn woods over which the light and shadow traveled swiftly, as if heavenly wings were sweeping on benignant errands through the summer air, the smooth green slopes, the glittering water, the garden where the flowers were so symmetrically arranged in clusters of the richest colors, how beautiful they looked. The house, with gable and chimney, and tower, and turret, and dark doorway, and broad terrace walk, twining among the balustrades of which, and lying heaped upon the vases, there was one great flush of roses, seemed scarcely real in its light solidity, and in the serene and peaceful hush that rested on all around it. To Ada and to me, that above all, appeared the pervading influence. On everything, house, garden, terrace, green slopes, water, old oaks, fern, moss, woods again, and far away across the openings, in the prospect to the distance lying wide before us with a purple bloom upon it, there seemed to be such undisturbed repose. When we came into the little village, and passed a small inn with the sign of the Deadlock Arms swinging over the road in front, Mr. Boythorn interchanged greetings with a young gentleman sitting on a bench outside the inn door who had some fishing tackle lying beside him. "That's the housekeeper's grandson, Mr. Rouncewell by name," said he, "and he is in love with a pretty girl up at the house. Lady Dedlock has taken a fancy to the pretty girl, and is going to keep her about her own fair person an honor which my young friend himself does not at all appreciate. However, he can't marry just yet, even if his rosebud were willing, so he is fain to make the best of it. In the meanwhile, he comes here pretty often for a day or two at a time to fish. Ha 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 ha! Are he and the pretty girl engaged, Mr. Boythorn?" asked Ada. "Why, my dear Miss Clare," he returned, "I think they may perhaps understand each other, but you will see them soon, I dare say, and I must learn from you on such a point, not you from me." Ada blushed, and Mr. Boythorn, trotting forward on his comely gray horse, dismounted at his own door and stood ready with extended arm and uncovered head, to welcome us when we arrived. He lived in a pretty house, formerly the parsonage house, with a lawn in front, a bright flower garden at the side, and a well-stocked orchard and kitchen garden in the rear, enclosed with a venerable wall that had of itself a ripened ruddy look. But, indeed, everything about the place wore an aspect of maturity and abundance. The old lime tree walk was like green cloisters, the very shadows of the cherry trees and apple trees were heavy with fruit, the gooseberry bushes were so laden that their branches arched and rested on the earth, the strawberries and raspberries grew in like profusion, and the peaches beasked by the hundred on the wall, tumbled about among the spread nets, and the glass frames sparkling and winking in the sun there were such heaps of drooping pods, and marrows, and cucumbers, that every foot of ground. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.